Well, I have a wonderful electronic invention I want you to see. It looks something like this.
Greetings, Curiosity Builders. I'm Chris Martin, and you're listening to Getting Work to Work, a weekly podcast for creative entrepreneurs, makers, artists, podcasters, writers, filmmakers, designers, and coders who are on a mission of bringing their ideas to life by creating new things and getting their work to work. Whether you're just starting out or have been at this creative life for some time, I hope you learn something new in this podcast, challenge your assumptions about what is possible, and chase big ideas so you can become who you were born to be. What do you do with a childhood dream of being an artist, an obsession with history, and a desire to build a community through inclusion of diverse perspectives? You do what today's guest on Getting Work to Work did and get busy creating work, starting businesses, and building relationships. Trey Sills is a creative entrepreneur, multidisciplinary designer, and founder of Vocal Type Co. and Seal Studio. From a foundation of curiosity and observation, Trey has built upon a family legacy of entrepreneurship and history to create a space that allows him to add diversity to design as well as do something different. Show notes and links to resources mentioned in this episode can be found at gwtw.co/356. You'll also find links to stream the show on the major podcast platforms, an opportunity to keep in touch with Chris Martin Studios through the Curiosity Lab, and ways to support Getting Work to Work by purchasing posters, swag packs, and more. Trey, welcome to Getting Work to Work. It is an absolute pleasure to have you on the show.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Yeah. What's one interesting bit of trivia people should know about you?
People always tell me this is kind of strange, but you know how kids say they want to be all these things when they grow up?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I always said I wanted to be an artist, and I didn't see myself having like gallery shows or anything like that. And I did know what a designer was at the time, so I always just said I wanted to be an artist, and that never really changed, and that's kind of what I am.
That's awesome. What was it about it when you were a kid that made you want to be an artist?
It was really therapeutic for me. At the ages of 4 and 8, I had a brain tumor.
Oh, wow.
At the age of 4, it was the size of a golf ball. And as I grew, it kind of grew with me. And and through that ordeal, like drawing and writing were my, kind of my coping mechanism. Just kind of helped, you know, make me stop thinking about the pain.
Yeah,
it just kind of got me through that ordeal. Even after it was gone, it just kind of helped me express my feelings and what I was thinking more.
Right. So art, in a sense, was less about a career and more about just getting through life and the things that life threw at you.
Exactly.
Wow.
And even today, like just as a graphic designer, still just designing and making in general helps me relax.
That's pretty awesome.
Right. So I'm like, why am I that? I should just have a job where I can relax all day.
I like that you think of creativity as relaxation. That's awesome. What's interesting about that too is like, did you dive right into being a graphic designer and an artist once you kind of knew that you wanted to be that? Or was there a path that you would call your entrepreneurial journey?
I was always inspired by my parents. They run their own business my entire life.
Oh, wow.
My dad started it back in 1980, and my mom basically runs the office now while he works in the field and with all the other workers. And that kind of determination just kind of inspired me. So I actually started my first kind of creative venture in the 5th grade.
Oh, wow.
my allowance at the time was only $2, $1 for myself and $1 for church. And I'm like, that's not going to work. So I started graffitiing people's names on index cards and selling them for $3 a piece.
Wow. I mean, didn't you tell your parents that a tithe was only 10%, not 50%?
Right. So that wasn't going to work. So I did that for about 2 years. And wow. Even after that, I was like, whoa, I can make money doing what I like. So I just kept, every time I thought about making something or there was something I want to buy, I started wondering if I could make that. Through like middle school and high school, I started making bead jewelry and bead bracelets. I started seeing them for like $300 and $400. Yet I found the beads online for like $10 and $20. I'm like, I can make that myself right now. And that was just kind of like the story of my life throughout high school. I saw something I liked but didn't want to invest my money in it, then I'd make it myself. I remember at the time Kanye West had come out with this album called 808s and Heartbreaks. And I'm not like a huge Kanye fan. I like his fashion more than anything. Mm-hmm. And he would wear like these Lego brooches, and they were like just a red heart, but it was a Lego brooch. And I bought a set of Legos and started playing with them. And then I bought a pin and I'll glue them to the back and sell them to my friends and give them for Christmas gifts.
That's awesome. It reminds me of like in my town, I'll see like people with a Supreme bumper sticker on the back, and it's like, did you just go to the print shop and make one yourself?
Right.
Exactly. Surely you didn't spend $10,000 on a bumper sticker.
Right. I was actually at the mall just the other day, and they had this shop that sold like quote unquote collectible sneakers and street apparel. Mm-hmm. And they had like this whole display case full of like used Supreme stuff, like a Supreme water gun and the Supreme bumper stickers. And they were used and they were still like $500. I'm like, why?
Well, I mean, at a certain point too, I mean, brand is one thing, but you know, how far is too far when you have something like that, you know?
Exactly.
So when you're creating all of these things, you're seeing something and you're recreating the experience, you're recreating the product. How did that lead you into becoming an official graphic designer, if you will?
I started messing around on the computer with quote unquote graphic design and like Microsoft Paint and Microsoft Word when I was in like
clip art.
Right? Exactly. When I was in like the seventh or eighth grade, Pharrell had come out with this album called In My Mind, and he had that little almost like Hello Kitty type character of himself. And I was like, I want one of those. I'm going to put one of those on a t-shirt and make one of myself. And it was terrible. But I was finally able to make one when I became official graphic designer. But that kind of introduced me to like playing more with the whole digital experience.
Yeah. That's so awesome too, because what a great way to learn the tools when you're trying to recreate what you're seeing.
Exactly.
What was the hardest thing to kind of wrap your mind around as you're learning these tools?
At the time, it was just kind of everything. I mean, I was playing with this old Photoshop CD-ROM I had gotten from Costco, and the only thing I really understood was photo filters, and beyond that I had no clue what to do with it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Until I got to college, I'm like, oh my god, you can do more than just use photo filters.
Yeah. Well, it's funny too, because you know, when you learn Photoshop, you're like, how do I make something look hand-drawn? Oh, I'll add a contour edges filter to it, and look, it's hand-drawn. Whereas, you know, then you dive into the world of drawing on the computer and vectors versus raster and all that stuff. I mean, that had to have blown your mind.
Definitely. The craziest thing that blew my mind. So when I was in high school, I got really good at like drawing in Microsoft Word with like their line tools and their circle tools and all that.
That's amazing.
That's how I survived my first year of college, was using Microsoft Word, because I didn't know how to use Illustrator at the time. And when I did figure out Illustrator, I found out that you can actually take those like Microsoft Word shapes and paste them in Illustrator, and they'll become vectors.
What? That's awesome. Wow.
Yep. Blew my mind.
Yeah.
So that's how I survived my first year of college.
That's awesome. It reminds me of when you can copy and paste Illustrator files in like a code editor and get like an SVG coding of it.
Right.
For like the programming side of things, and that's pretty mind-blowing as well.
Exactly.
Oh my gosh. Wow. So I mean, there, one of the things that I appreciate about you and your journey is that there seems to be like a very kind of exploratory, very kind of curiosity driven approach to what you do. And really kind of like, you seem to be full of wonder.
Definitely. I was always kind of exploring as a kid. So after I had the second tumor removed, my family would say that they replaced the tumor with a computer chip. Because I just became interested in everything and wanted to know everything about everything.
Yeah.
So when I had the second tumor, during that time, I experienced racism for the first time, which was in the third grade, which was crazy to me. And then in fourth grade, my parents sent me to an international day school where I started learning about Hispanic culture and Latina culture and Black history. And that just made racism more confusing to me. And I just started observing more. And it just made me want to know more and more about everything. And that kind of continues. That's kind of what keeps my spark going.
Yeah. So your interest in history really started young then.
Definitely. Back in 1911, my three times great grandparents founded a farm in this town 20 miles outside of D.C. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother was raised on this farm. My father was born and raised and still lives on this farm. And actually, my house is next door to theirs. It used to be a chicken coop. And my studio used to be the stable.
That's awesome.
So I've always just kind of been interested in the history of the place and just interested in the time period. And it just made me want to know more and more about like my family history, where the name comes from and all kinds of stuff.
And history really seems to be a recurring theme in everything that you do, from your studio to your type company.
I'm a firm believer that history repeats itself three times, if not more. And as I started like looking into history when I was in high school, I was like one of my favorite subjects outside of art, obviously. I started seeing these patterns in like the way history repeats itself. Mm-hmm. Like I can see how this one event caused all this thing, all these different events, and led us to where we are today. And I started seeing all these different patterns. They have this quote that history is told by the people who won.
Yeah.
And I've always been interested in what like textbook companies choose to put and exclude in textbooks. Mm-hmm. I'll never forget during my senior year of high school, we were on the last chapter and it was starting to get into current events and we were at the 90s. And for some reason, they had to include NSYNC and Britney Spears in this world history book. And I'm so confused. I'm like, why not talk about any other type of music and only them? I mean, I understand including MTV, but Britney Spears and NSYNC?
Yeah.
So it just made me more interested in like the history that you don't learn about in school.
Right. Well, and especially when it comes to the creative pursuits, you know, the history, you know, what is the history behind the work that we do? If creative history is written by the winners, you know, what have we lost along the way by the people that weren't recognized, that weren't supported, but yet had a fundamental impact on someone at least?
Definitely. Like, I'll never forget, I took an art history class when I was in during my freshman year. And we're starting to learn about all these famous painters and all these different periods. Mm-hmm. And they were all European. And I always started wondering, well, like, what was going on in Africa at the time? What was going on throughout Asia at the time? In South America? And that kind of curiosity really helps me in terms of, like, my branding projects and working within the studio. Like, I always start looking at logos from different countries. Like, what logos look like in Japan and China and throughout Africa. And I'm always interested in looking at specifically Chinese and Japanese logos because I was always taught not to have a lot of text in a logo. But most of their logos include like the Chinese or Japanese translation and the English translation and an icon and all these other things. And it's just huge.
Oh, that's amazing.
It just kind of redefined what a logo can and should be for me.
Yeah. Was there a certain moment that really surprised you when it came to other cultures' branding?
I was surprised at how similar everything was. Like, I'm always amazed at how, hold me back up. There's this book by Sagmeister and Walsh. I think it's called Beauty, if I'm not mistaken. And in that book, they talk about how there's these three European architects that have influenced architecture throughout the entire world. So like, what used to be these very ornate Chinese and Japanese buildings are now like 3D cubes. Like, and that's how it is in all throughout the world. And that's how I felt when I was looking at logos from other countries. Like, just this idea of globalization took place a long time ago. And I'm still searching for logos from other countries that happened before that time, but they're so rare.
Yeah. Interesting. I wonder too if the expression of the brand changes in different countries as well, because, you know, we think about branding cattle, you know, so you know, what does the actual shape of the brand look like in different countries?
Exactly.
Now I'm curious. Yes, right? Curiosity is infectious.
Exactly. Working with Focal has kind of increased my curiosity.
Oh, wow.
Most recently, I actually found out what font was used for like the I Am a Man fonts in the Memphis Sanitation Strike of 1968, which was the first font I released. And it was actually from Hamilton Woodtype.
Oh, wow.
And I couldn't believe it because I kept getting emails from people like, that's Railroad Gothic or Within the Family, and that's from this and that's from that. And I actually found it.
That's really cool. Wow. So you've mentioned Vocal Type a couple of times. Why start your own font foundry? I mean, aren't there enough fonts in the world?
I mean, yeah. But so I actually started working on my first font during my senior year of high school.
That's awesome.
All I knew was how to draw it. I didn't know what it was going to turn into, but I figured one day I'd learn how to use the technology I need to make it a real font. And then in 2013, I think I was a sophomore in college, and I turned it into a vector font. Still didn't know how to make like a real font. So it was just like an SVG file. And I called it Unveil. And essentially what it was Futura wrapped in these kind of scrolls or ribbons. And it had like five different layers. And I released it on Behance, and I think I checked it like 2 years later, and it had been downloaded 30,000 times. And I was like, oh my God, I wish I had charged 50 cents. And that's when I really got bit by the bug. And I just started looking for other opportunities to make custom type. So like I did an internship in Minneapolis back in 2014. And the studio was named Wink. And they had, when they first started, they got so busy so fast that they never had time to actually refine their logo. So all they had was an icon with a W, like a stenciled W, and an I in it.
Oh, wow.
They didn't have like an actual word mark. And while I was there, I started exploring what it would look like if you took that one W icon and turned it into an entire typeface. And it became really weird, almost like puzzle pieces. And less of a stencil. And I was like, oh my God, this is so much fun. It made branding more fun for me.
Yeah.
Because prior to starting Vocal, I was working on a branding project and looking for inspiration. And I got really bored all of a sudden, like deep depression within split seconds.
Wow. And, whoa, split second. Whoa.
Yeah, it was the weirdest thing. Like I was looking for inspiration. I had gone through my library. I went on Behance, I went on Pinterest, I went on Dribbble, I went to all these places, and everything started to look the same to me.
Yeah, wow.
And I was just blown away. I started like asking, had I chosen the wrong career? What am I doing? what do I do if I'm not doing this? Because I don't know what else I would do. what else I would actually like to do.
Because you wanted to be an artist your whole life.
Right, exactly. I did a lot of work after I graduated. So like to this date, I've done work for almost 250 clients.
Whoa.
So like when I graduated, I had done a lot of work for a ton of different companies and a ton of different people. And I don't know if you call it burnout or not, but I just wasn't inspired by anything.
Yeah.
And I can't remember for the life of me, but I started looking into like the demographics of the design industry. And I can't remember why I started looking it up or what made me think of to search for that. And the next thing I see is like this article called Black Designers Missing in Action from, I think it was like either 86 or 87, written by this lady named Dr. Cheryl D. Millick. And it was basically talking about how the design industry, while we create all these designs for a global community, our community isn't as diverse as the world we're creating it for. So like in order to make more impactful designs, you actually need, like, if you want to communicate a design to a Black community, then you need Black designers at the table. Or if you want to communicate to Brown communities, you need Brown designers at the table, and LGBTQ and women and so on. They all need to see the table. And I still wasn't really seeing that. But that was the first time that someone had actually brought up the idea of diversity in design. And then I started seeing demographics from the Department of Labor, and it was like only 3% of all designers in America are Black. And that's like fashion design, graphic design, interior design, everything. And I was just blown away by this. And at the time, women were still a minority, but they're a majority now, but they still don't have the leadership positions that they need to make a real impact. But it just got me thinking, well, how can I add diversity to design? It's not like I can change demographics or anything like that.
Right.
And it was like, I started thinking about my life because I'm in panic mode now.
Right.
I'm like, well, I always loved writing in cursive. I started graffitiing index cards in fifth grade. I designed tattoos in high school. I made my first font at the end of high school. Let me start a font company.
Yeah. I mean, that's a logical progression.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, what do I do? Like, how do I do something that's different? And I started remembering like all these things I had learned from Black history and going to this international day school. And I remember like the Memphis sanitation strike in 1968, because that was Dr. King's last cause he got to fight for before being killed. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I'm like, well, I'll make a font on that first. And then I just started researching more and more and more history of different cultures. And it just kind of progressed from there.
How did that progression change the sense of boredom and deep depression you mentioned once you started diving in?
Oh, wow. I really got my spark back. I quit my job. I'm like, I'm starting a font company and a design studio as well.
Oh, so you started them simultaneously?
Yes.
Woo!
Yep. Actually, I got incorporated like the summer I graduated.
That's awesome.
And I'm like, I'm going to get this studio built because I wanted to be in this bar because I hate working in the city and commuting. Because I actually did the calculations and I think I spend like 48 or 42 days out of the year in traffic just commuting to and from work.
Oh, wow.
And I'm like, I'm not doing that the rest of my life. I just started working on vocal and working on my font design skills. And I was still working in Illustrator at the time. They had just released this font software called FontSelf. It's an Illustrator plugin and a Photoshop plugin. Cool. And you can make like color fonts and all kinds of stuff. So that's how I got started. Cool. It was really from working, I guess, that year and a half or close to 2 years in the city that really made diversity important to me. Because it got really, I guess I don't want to call it depression, but like my sense of self-awareness really started heightening while I was working in the city. Mm. It's weird being the only person that looks like you in an office of 30 plus people. And then you go to lunch and all the people that look like you are serving behind the counter.
Wow.
And it kind of makes you feel bad for, you know, getting to where you are. Mm. And I wanted to figure out a way to bring people up with me and not just kind of be here by myself.
Wow.
And that's when I tried to make vocal not only work, but more of a community type thing.
Is that overwhelming to think about how you're going to be the example and bring people up with you?
A little bit, yeah. It's really weird, people coming up to me and asking me questions. And I know people say because you specialize in something, you're an expert. But I've only been doing this 3 years now, 3 or 4 years. Mm. Yeah, about 3 years now. And I'm just amazed at how fast vocal has grown and how fast people have grown to know it and like it and use it. I mean, I'm honored, but at the same time, it's like, I want to highlight other people doing what I'm doing. Like, I know I'm not, for a fact, I'm not the only one that's trying to bring others up with me. So I want to highlight those people as well.
So would you say that that's what community means to you? Because there's a paragraph in your manifesto that is really powerful. You say vocal is for the creative that cares about telling the stories of the people we serve and the history of the industry we work in. Vocal is for the creative that wants to build a community, not a following. Is that what you're talking about?
Definitely. I don't want to take credit for doing this alone because too many people have helped me along the way.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'll never forget Maurice Cherry. He runs a podcast called Revision Path, and he's the one who really gave me my first break. Like, he's the one who first discovered vocal, and that was the first piece of press I ever got.
That's cool. Yeah, I've heard of Maurice.
Yeah, and I have to thank Dr. Cheryl D. Miller, who wrote the article, Black Designers Missing in Action. And for her sequel, Black Designer Still Missing in Action, she released in 2016, that also really inspired me. When I read that sequel, I actually contacted her and was like, what do you think of this idea? I know I'm not really like a type designer yet, but I want to start this font foundry. And she was like, you need to start calling yourself a type designer because you are.
Yeah.
Even though you may not get the level of experience, you may not have the level of experience that you're looking for, you are one. And she, I'll never forget, she said, you better do it before somebody else does.
Ooh, that's awesome.
And then, like, just so many people helped me along the way. I met Gail Anderson, and I'll never forget, she bought every single one of my fonts. The next thing I know, she's using it for a poster exhibition in Chicago, and she sends me a signed copy of the poster.
That's cool.
Just all these people just kind of rallying around and helping me along the way.
How humbling.
Exactly. Like, I want to raise their voices too, because I did not get here alone.
That's awesome. As you dive into becoming a type designer, what surprised you the most about the process? I mean, it's an insanely in-depth process.
It's weird. Type design is like, it's that drawing class, it's that geometry class that you never paid attention to. Like all those drawing techniques that people are like, this is bullshit. You need all of them.
That's awesome.
And all the geometry that you never pay attention to, you need all of it. Like I was a horrible math student. And now I feel like all I'm doing are calculations and rules of third and proportions.
Wow.
I'm just amazed at all of the nuances that go into building a typeface.
Is there some that you still struggle with versus others? I mean, I imagine that the more you create, the more you start internalizing the process. But are there things that still cause you to pause and have to really think and sketch and explore?
The letter S is like the worst letter to make. And the ampersand, they give me the most grief. Like I've heard of font companies actually like, so let's say I would apply to work at another font foundry.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard of foundries that would give you a blank screen and you have to make a letter S from scratch without sketching it.
Oh my gosh.
Like that's their test to see your skill level.
Wow.
So it is literally one of the hardest characters to make, and it still gives me grief.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I have a hard enough time just drawing a letter S. And then as I start thinking about the pen tool, and I'm like, all right, I have to have a curve here. Do I do a corner point here or do I curve it?
Exactly.
Ah! I start freaking out in my head.
Exactly. Like during my workshop at Bend Design, I was showing people how like you can make, I think it's about 70% of all lowercase characters just by drawing the lowercase N first, and how you can make the majority of all your uppercase characters just by drawing uppercase H and uppercase O first. But S is like one of those characters that doesn't come from anything. Like you can't base it off any of those characters. You might be able to base proportions, but that's as far as you can go.
Yeah. Wow. Did you have to learn the terminology of typography to understand creating fonts better? Or is it something that you don't have to worry too much about the language of typography, like counters and grid lines and things like that?
I mean, grid lines are a huge thing, but terminology, I don't really pay that much attention to it. Like, I just know what goes where.
That's awesome.
It's like an anatomy class. Where like you have to learn the parts of the body, you have to learn the parts of the letter. So like you have, it's weird. It has like a combination of like plant and human body parts. So like there's a tail and there's a stem, and then there's also a crotch and just all these random parts that I'm not really sure I've ever had to like actually talk about those parts. So I never actually think about them. I just have a brief that I set aside and I'll work based on that brief.
I'm always curious about process because it's like, does knowing the actual terminology or the actual names for things make things better? Or do you just do it because it has become second nature and you don't really need to be concerned with that?
I think it's good to know it just to build your understanding of how it works. But in terms of like actually building a typeface, unless you're like getting critiqued by someone, then otherwise, I don't think it's actually important in building a typeface.
Interesting. One of the things as I was thinking about our conversation, you know, I'm curious as to how do we move the conversation from something as superficial as, wow, this font looks so cool, to this is what the font represents and this is how it connects to, be it your movement, your product, or your company.
It's hard. I can always, I'm always getting emails from people like, thank you so much for making this font, you're making this font, here's what I made with it. And I can always tell who read the history of it versus who didn't. Don't get me wrong, this example was extremely beautiful. My most popular font, Martin, was used for this men's fashion magazine in Europe. And it was used throughout the entire magazine, headline size, sub-headlines, tertiary headlines, everywhere.
Wow.
And it was extremely beautiful, but there wasn't a single person of color in the magazine. It was all about fashion.
Oh, interesting.
Part of me is always curious about the decision behind, or like how people use my fonts. Because part of me wants people to use them for not just for like the nonprofit or for the protest sign or for the logo, but I like the idea of it being injected into just plain old design culture. And that's kind of the thing that amazes me about the fonts I'm creating, is that if you strip away the history, if you strip away all the character, well, not the character, but just like the history of it and the context of it, it just kind of looks like a font that any other font foundry made.
Yeah. And yet the history is what makes it amazing.
Exactly. And part of me is like, if only diversity could work that way.
Oh, man. Oh, I mean, I just really appreciate, because when I first met you, you're like, yeah, I make type based on protest signs. But it's so much more than that. I mean, there is almost a wonderland of history and of reality and of truth and of, I guess, just importance that makes me reconsider what my relationship to design and typography and other people is. And I think that's the power of what you're doing. I think that's what makes it so awesome.
Actually, me and Jessica Bellamy were interviewing each other at the conference, and we were wondering what design would look like if other people were kind of forced to promote their culture as much as we have to, or like defend their culture as much as we have to. Like, we're talking about how once upon a time, like the Irish and the Jews and the Italians were considered white. So what would happen if they were forced to kind of analyze and promote and defend their history?
Yeah.
Like what would happen if the Irish started making typefaces that weren't just Celtic knots and swishes? What would happen if they started analyzing their history and making type based on that? I don't know. Working with type kind of makes me analyze its uses more as well. Fonts that I used to love, like Bodoni and all of these bold Gothics and grotesques, when you see them in the context of, let's say, a sign for a slave auction or a wanted sign for a runaway slave, then it kind of changed my relationship with type of like words, so European type. And I just wonder, like, I'm always curious of should the context of its use kind of defend its value, or should it just be valued for its craftsmanship?
And what is the responsibility of the designer to go back and look at the positive and negative uses of a font like that?
Exactly. Like, I think it was called Newland, which you would see used on a lot of different African-American movie posters some time ago. And then it kind of transitioned to everyone using Franklin Gothic and only like black weight fonts to represent black people. And I'm always interested in like where type becomes stereotyped.
Yeah. Wow.
And like, is there a way to combat that from the designer's perspective, or is that even the designer's responsibility?
Wow. I mean, that's deep to I've never ever considered racism in terms of the weight of a font.
Right.
That's, I mean, wow. Oh, wow. What do you think the responsibility is of the designer to consider all of this?
I'm not sure if it's the responsibility of the type designer or not, because we're just kind of like a catalyst for the design. We're not the actual designers putting together these compositions. But I think it just goes back to inclusivity and understanding other people. And yeah. Once you understand people more, then you can understand why this font might not work for this project, or not only why it wouldn't work for this project, but why I probably shouldn't use it for like this type of client or this subject matter.
One of the things that you said, and you just mentioned it as well, is just this idea and notion of inclusivity. And at your recent talk at Bend Design, you made a comment that really struck me. And you said that diversity is systemic, but we can all be inclusive. And we do that by understanding and listening. Understanding is the key to inclusion. And I think while that paragraph really says it all, how can design and creativity and designers and creative entrepreneurs really push themselves to be more inclusive?
When I graduated college, I took a job at a staffing agency called the Creative Group. Hmm. And during that time, I was their first full-time hire in the DC office, which meant I could go on contracts for like a month here or 3 months there instead of just week-long temp jobs. Hmm. And at some of the companies, I was always amazed at how some people would get offended when I would try to get to know them, or how little these coworkers who had been working with each other for years knew little to nothing about each other. Hmm. I'll never forget, I was talking to this guy who was in an IT department at this company I worked with. And he was telling me about his husband and how he's this amazing photographer. And he was showing me all his photographs. And I was like, man, I'd love to hire him for this. And I think it was like a couple of months later, there was a Christmas party coming up. And this guy walks up to him and was like, are you bringing your girlfriend? And he was like, no, I'm bringing my husband. He was like, oh, I didn't know you were gay. And they've been working with each other for over a year.
Wow.
I'm always intrigued by like how little we understand each other. And how like we can work in the same environment with one another and know so little. I worked at a company where I got really close with this one guy, and we're still friends to this day. And I went back to work for that company a while later, and like about 2 years later, and some of the people who had been working with him all that time that I was gone are just finding out that he has sisters.
Wow.
And I just think inclusivity is about getting to know each other. And once you understand people, then you can understand clients, and you don't have to do focus groups just to understand a target market. You can, all you really need to do is talk to people and get to know people, and that can inform so much.
Mm-hmm. And yet, what do you think the barriers to understanding people are? Is it time? Is it money? Is it ignorance? I mean, you know, what is it that really holds us back from that understanding?
I think it's a bit of all of them. I think mostly it's time. Like, especially on the East Coast, everything moves so fast and everybody wants everything done right now or yesterday.
Right.
And there really isn't time to get to know each other. Mm-hmm. And just the fact that people can work with each other for so long and know so little, it's kind of disturbing. And it just speaks to how little time we really have in terms of like work-life balance. And I think companies could really work on being more inclusive. Like, I think going around and introducing a new employee to everybody is like a great thing to do.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
It can like spark interest and build new relationships. But if you're just going to bring on a new hire and throw them into this environment that they're not used to and just kind of let them ease into it on their own and struggle through it, then that's not really being inclusive.
Yeah. Interesting. Do you think of time differently because of going through the experience of having two brain tumors?
I've been told that I care more than most. I value things more. I care about the success of the people that I work with more than I probably should. I've been burned quite a few times by clients, but I still want them to succeed, which is kind of weird. But
that's amazing.
I just feel like I value things that most people don't care about more, like tradition and history and just like finding the meaning in things that people don't find meaning in. For example, when I'm doing a branding project, every single thing that I do has to have a meaning behind it or a reason behind it. Most recently, I did a branding project for this advertising agency called Rivet, and they advertise to college students. During that project, I found out that Rivet means to direct one's eye or attention. So, like, all the colors are based on the colors that house the advertisements that they put on these campuses. The typefaces are, like, the LED signs that you would see on construction sites or on highway signage and road signs, things that automatically grab people's attention and direct people's eye. And just that putting that kind of reasoning behind the project is one of the main reasons people say I put a lot of care into my work and care more than I probably should.
Well, as you're describing your level of care, it does make me think of a word that you've used on kind of your upcoming projects page, and it's the word become. And I'm really intrigued by this because you write thoughts become words, words become actions, actions become habits, habits become character, and character becomes destiny. I mean, that gives me chills reading it and saying out loud, but what is it about the word become that really inspires you to move from one state of being to another?
The main reason I put that quote on the homepage of the site is it kind of speaks to my life story. Back in 2014, I made a pact with myself that by the time I was 25, I would be an internationally renowned designer.
That's awesome.
And I said that to myself like every week or every day, if I could remember. And these words kind of became actions, and I started working harder and putting more effort into my work. And the next thing I know, it became this kind of snowball effect of opportunities and hard life lessons. During my senior year of college, about a few months after I made this pact with myself, I get a new professor. And the next thing I know, she's having us do a project for Black & Decker, and we're going to Black & Decker's headquarters and pitching these project ideas to them. She entered us in this international competition where we had to reimagine an in-store experience for Whole Foods, and my team and I won.
Wow.
I graduated with like seven or eight job offers.
Wow.
Just the idea of things, but like actions becoming words, words becoming actions. During my internship in 2014, like, it's just weird how all these things kind of came together and became what I'm doing today. The last day of my internship, my boss told me, wherever you go, make sure that you don't become a wrist. And a wrist is essentially someone who simply designs whatever their boss or their client tells them to do without putting any thought into it. And I don't know if it's subconscious. I don't know if he's a wizard or something like that. But ever since then, every single time I felt I was being a wrist, I got carpal tunnel.
Wow.
And once the job was over or I quit that job, it would go away.
That's amazing.
Or just like last October, I started a personal project working on my type design skills. And I was curious what would happen if the Adobe A in their logo became a typeface. Because you know how everybody, all these big companies are getting custom typefaces now.
Yeah.
And I started working on this, and it was a lot of fun. And then about a month later, I get an email from Deanne Holton, who's one of the board members of AIGA DC. And she's like, hey, I want you to make some social media graphics for this guy who's coming to speak. And he used to work at the New York Times, but now he's like a principal at Adobe. I'm like, oh my God, I'm using this right now. And awesome. I use it, and he loves it. I get to meet him at this talk. And then the next thing I know, he's emailing me asking for a poster version of the social media graphics I made for his talk. And then he's introducing me to his coworkers, and I'm doing a project for Adobe.
That's amazing.
And I think like all these different experiences just kind of culminate to show how thoughts really become words, become actions, become destiny.
Yeah. Well, and it also speaks to what you say as being a firm believer that everything happens for a reason. I mean,
exactly.
All of these stories are amazing examples of that. I mean, when you sit back and look at your journey, I mean, does it just blow you away at where you are today?
It feels fake. It feels like a Lifetime movie or something that just only happens in the movies or on TV. And I look like I still can't believe where I am.
Yeah.
Now, I kind of feel like that's a good thing because it keeps you humble and keeps you going. But at the same time, I'm just kind of amazed.
Yeah. How does it change how you think about the future? I mean, when you say you're going to be an internationally renowned designer, what's after that? I mean, how do you think even beyond that? Or do you change what greatness or mastery means in this context once you achieve something like that?
My goals really changed over time, like going through this journey. Like once upon a time, I had like this list of Fortune 500 companies I wanted to do work with. And as the years have gone by and like memories have kind of blurred together, they don't feel important to me anymore. Like I want to do something that that does more change than get fame, if that makes sense. And it just kind of redefined my definition of what internationally known means, because you can be known for a lot of things, good and bad.
Yeah.
But I hope I do more good than anything else with this fame or whatever you like to call it.
So how do you balance all that you do? I mean, is balance something that you strive for? Because you're running a brand consultancy, a font foundry, you're doing all these amazing projects. What does balance look like?
It's hard. Like, for example, my studio and personal social media haven't been updated in months, but I try to keep vocal as up to date as possible. But at the same time, they kind of merge together in a way. So, like, because I'm able to make typefaces through vocal, I can also make type design and offering through my studio, which kind of adds to a competitive advantage because I only know of one other agency that actually makes typefaces in all of D.C., Maryland, and Virginia.
Wow.
And just that competitive advantage just kind of keeps the idea of kind of keeps me balanced in terms of focusing on both of them. Like there's a benefit to actually doing both.
Yeah.
And I think just like I've always been experimenting in companies. Like I've always wanted to just try anything I could make into a company. I wanted to at least try it. And if it didn't work, it didn't work. Oh, well.
Well, Trey, this has been so much fun. I've enjoyed just learning even more about you and the work that you do. And the last question that I have for you is, what was the last book or podcast that blew your mind?
I think the first and only book that really blew my mind was The Alchemist by Paulo Coelho.
Yeah.
And I don't want to ruin it for anyone, but essentially there's this kid who believes that every single person on earth has their own personal treasure. And he goes on this journey to find his. And he leaves his home, he leaves his family, he gets robbed and all these horrible things happen to him. And he ends up in a completely different country digging for his personal treasure. And he doesn't find it and come to find out that his personal treasure was at home, at a place where he went every single day. And that just kind of led me to not want to start a practice in the city and stay where my roots are.
Yeah. So would you define your personal treasure as your roots?
Definitely.
Well, Trey, thank you so much for being on Getting Work to Work. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I hope that people will check out your work at Seals.studio and Vocal Type as well. And I'll make sure that people can find those links in the show notes. So thank you so much.
Much appreciated. Thank you.
One thing I'd like to point out, that all artwork that I've created for this episode, from the banner on the episode to the social media posts, were created with Baird by Vocal Type Co. From the website, Vocal Type writes, "Baird is a unique sans serif typeface inspired by signs from the 1963 March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom." I really encourage you to learn more about the history behind this font and all of the other fonts created by Vocal Type Co. And I I've included the link on the show notes page at gwtw.co/356. Until next time, may creativity and curiosity fuel your life.